Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They say actions speak louder than words. Last week, there was a tempest over whether Fidel Castro had said the Cuban model of socialism no longer worked. This week, the Cuban government announced a 500,000 state workers will be laid off. In a country where the state-owned economy is almost everything, that is a big deal. Is Cuba really getting on a new path like China, something else? This hour on Point, Fidel, socialism, and change. You can join the conversation in a Cuban economy 95% state-owned. What will all those laid-off state workers do? Will they build a new economy? Will they be allowed to? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will look at yesterday's big primary day victories for the Tea Party and ask what they mean for the GOP. But first, to the news from Cuba. Francis Robles joins me from Miami, a reporter for the Miami Herald who's been watching Havana. Francis, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So 500,000 workers to lose their state jobs. Give us a sense of how big a deal that is in a country of only 11 million people.
That's a pretty cataclysmic shift. I mean, imagine just in your own companies that you work for if 10% of the workforce was laid off. Now imagine if that 10% had only worked there, had only worked for that company. That's what you have. You have people that know no other employer except the Cuban government suddenly being told, hey, you know, but what, by April, you're going to have to figure out a way to make it on your own.
Why is this happening? There was talk. I mean, Fidel Castro's brother Raul was saying they have 1 million too many employees by the state. They're just laying off 500,000 now. But why?
They have just way too many people on their payroll. I mean, you can go into an office in Cuba, and it's actually almost comical, where you'll have somebody who's in charge of the fax machine, and you have somebody who's in charge of answering the phones. But, you know, if the phone lady goes to the restroom, you know, she won't deal with the fax lady, won't answer the phone, because that's not my job. I'm in charge of the fax machine, you're in charge of the phone. And so you have a lot of people who show up late, who don't come to work, and it's a huge drain on the Cuban economy. At the end of the day, they just can't pay all these salaries, even though the salaries are so, so low.
And Raul Castro's been talking about that. He's been complaining about people on the state payroll that aren't carrying their weight, aren't doing enough.
They're really not. And so he's been kind of sort of telling people, look, we're going to start paying you according to your work, which was a pretty big deal there. You know, wait a second, you're going to pay me based on my value? Doesn't that go against the socialist utopia that we were told that this was all about? And so that's the bottom line, saying, you know what, if you're a slacker, if we don't need you here, you're going to have to go. And so the plan is to take about 10% of the workforce and split them in half in two different groups. One group would do more private cooperatives, so that if there's a restaurant, let's say, or some kind of business, say, okay, the employees are going to run this place. And the other half would do more of the traditional self-employment, plumber, you know, raising pigs, selling flowers, things of that nature. And the big question is whether the Cuban government is going to be able to pull this off.
Well, one wonders if there's enough of a private sector for that to happen. You go back to 1968, I mean, Fidel Castro nationalized basically everything in the Cuban economy, right down to shops and hamburger stands and shoe repair shops, nationalized, socialized, all of it. Is there enough now for these 500,000 people to do?
Well, a lot of the one thing that's going to be interesting is that a lot of these people are working independently anyway. They're just doing it illegally. So the question is there going to be enough work for all of these people to do it legally? So, for example, if all of a sudden there's X number of new, you know, shoemakers, all right, is the government going to control? Are they going to control the shoemakers? Are they going to have enough leather? Are there going to be enough hammers for them to work? And if are they going to be overregulated? Are they going to be overtaxed? So that's when I say, are they going to be able to pull it off? Do they know how to do this well? That's the big question. Last year, they started this with agriculture. They gave a lot of land to farmers. And agricultural output declined this year because there wasn't enough tractors, there weren't enough seeds, there weren't enough this, there weren't enough that. And so these little pilot programs have had mixed results so far.
They've had rice shortages. The sugar crop has been disastrous. It's not that easy to make this transition. I wonder where Fidel Castro himself comes down in all this. He made headlines when he appeared for the first time in full military dress since Raul took over early in September. before a lot of students in Havana. Here's a little bit from that speech at Havana University, September 3rd. Sort of a new, more public, assertive role for Fidel Castro, who had been quite ill. He began by reminding the students of the revolutionary days. Let's listen, Francis. I'll give a little of the English here.
Nuestra lucha por la liberación nacional se mezcló con el tenaz esfuerzo de los trabajadores de nuestro país por su...
Fidel Castro on September 3rd saying, our struggle for national liberation was mixed together with the tenacious efforts of the workers of our country for their social liberation. What's up with Fidel Castro these days? He was quoted as saying the Cuban model had failed and then came back out and said, no, that's not what he meant. It meant that capitalism did not work, at least American style. What's with the new public prominence of Fidel, Francis?
Well, I think he wants to show everyone, he wants to underscore very clearly that he's back and he's alive and kicking. But it's very interesting to see that he doesn't touch domestic issues. He's been really fixated on nuclear war in Iran and Israel. In the past couple of years, he was really fixated on the price of corn and world hunger. And it was kind of ironic because, you know, there's huge problems in Cuba, and he never talks about those. He doesn't address them at all. I mean, there's no question where he stands on private businesses. In the mid-90s, the Cuban government did a big push similar to the one that they're doing now, although they didn't lay people off, giving licenses to something like 220,000 private businesses. And when the economy got its sea legs back, the first thing that Fidel Castro did was eliminate more than half of those licenses. And so everybody knows where he stands. He's kind of, at this moment, sort of staying out of it. He says, well, let me putz around about Israel and nuclear war and things that make absolutely no difference to the people on the streets of Havana.
And what about the economy overall? Raul's supposed to be in charge. Is it possible that Cuba is taking its first tentative steps towards something like China did? And years ago, it was very little moves away from the socialist system that ended up opening a flood. Are people talking about that as a possibility in Cuba or no?
People have been talking about that for quite some time, and it went a little slower than anticipated. I think when Fidel Castro first got sick, and remember that it's been 4 years, everybody thought, oh, Raul's going to make this Vietnam, Raul's going to make this China. And, you know, what did he do? He allowed DVD players and cell phones. So he's been very tentative. He's been taking little steps. But now there's no question that he's understanding that there have to be some principles of free market in order for this to survive. I mean, even in the plan that he's proposing for these new 500,000 laid-off workers, he's acknowledging that a good number of these businesses are going to fail.
Francis Robles with the Miami Herald, watching Havana and what's going on in Cuba there. Thank you so much for being with us, Francis.
Thank you, Tom.
Here's a bit more from Fidel Castro's September 3rd speech, focused almost exclusively on the dangers of war between Iran and the U.S., but it began by emphasizing Cuba's heroic role in resisting American dominance, the American way.
No pareciera posible que un país tan pequeño como Cuba...
It would not seem possible, Fidel said, that a country as small as Cuba would be obligated to carry the weight of the struggle against those who have globalized and submitted the world to an inconceivable plunder and have imposed a system which today is threatening the very survival of humankind. Joining me now from Washington is Tom Jelton, National Security and International Affairs Correspondent for NPR. He covered Cuba for NPR for many years, has been often. He's author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. Tom Jelton, great to have you with us.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
What do you make of this news? Last week it was over rhetoric, but this week it's 500,000 Cubans laid off from government jobs in a country where the government jobs are almost everything.
You're right. In fact, I think that right now, Tom, there are only about 500,000 self-employed Cubans or Cubans working in the private sector. Mm-hmm. Basically, the private sector is a sector of self-employment because there are no private enterprises that are more than a couple people. So what we're talking about here, if all of those 500,000 laid off from state enterprises were to go to work in the private sector, that would require a doubling of private sector employment in Cuba. That's very hard to imagine. And I think the only way it can happen, and Francis was alluding to this, I think the only way it can happen would be if there were some major policy changes in Cuba to nurture and support the development of private enterprise. So far, we have not seen that. Otherwise, I just don't see any way that those people could find alternative employment.
I mean, there have been little things. I'm reading here from the New York Times report, the government's has handed tens of thousands of acres of state-held farmland to private farmers, begun freeing up some market for agricultural supplies, you know, allowed barber shops to become cooperatives, more license to private taxi drivers. But you're saying that doesn't begin to make enough room in the economy for this number of out-of-work people soon.
Well, there's still a lot of rules that make it difficult to develop a business, even a tiny business in Cuba. I'll give you one example, Tom. Mm-hmm. When I went to Cuba, I used to like to go to the tourist markets where they sell souvenirs. And one of the reasons is because the shortage of foreign currency in Cuba means you don't see any made in China souvenirs. All the souvenirs that are on sale are made by Cubans by hand. So you see some really clever little things. And I found this this guy who made toys out of old soda cans and beer cans. Just marvelous little inventions, and the doors opened and the wheels went around, and I couldn't believe the ingenuity that he showed in making those, and yet he was selling them himself in the stand. And I say, why don't you just stay home and turn these out and have somebody else sell them in the market? And he said the regulation was that he had to personally sell every single item that he made. So he had to basically stand in the market all day and sell these things and then go home and work. Now, if he could set up a little workshop where he made those toys and then had someone else sell them, he could double his output. But that was not allowed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Cuba making changes. 500,000 state workers to be cut loose from their government jobs. Fidel Castro making headlines. Later in this hour, we'll talk about Tea Party victories and the GOP. NPR's Tom Gelton joins us from Washington, author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Covered Cuba for many years for NPR. We'll hear in a moment from the dean of American Economist looking down at Cuba. But first, a little more tape. Here's Fidel again at that September 3rd speech. Very rare. Full military uniform. We haven't seen much of him since he was very ill a couple of years ago, and Raul stepped into the top spot. Here he is talking about his government's founding Marxist ideology.
La distribución justa de las riquezas materiales y espirituales que el hombre es capaz de crear.
Saying here, the fair distribution of material and spiritual wealth which mankind is capable of creating through the fabulous development of those producing it, that is the only possible alternative. But here we've got Raul Castro in August talking about the push for more self-employment.
The Council of Ministers has agreed to expand the issuance of self-employment accounts for the employment of excellent workers.
Fidel's brother Raul saying self-employment, we're going to have more of those permits. Joining us right now from Pittsburgh is Carmelo Mesa Lago, renowned economist and Cuba expert, professor emeritus of economics and Latin American studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Carmelo Mesa Lago, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
What do you see going on in this latest announcement of 500,000 layoffs in Cuba, where the government runs 95% of the economy? Is this a big deal?
Yes. I think it will be probably the most radical reform so far undertaken by Raul. He promised 3 years ago, in July 26, 2007, that there will be a structural reforms. But as has been already said, there have been only few of them, and the whole process has been very slow. So this, I would say, is the most important one so far. And of course, this is only the first step. 500,000, which is 10% of the labor force, and that is supposed to happen in the next 6 months. But actually, Raul, in a speech last August, mentioned 1.3 million. People to be dismissed, and that will be 26% of the labor force.
Wow. This is huge. You were just there in June, Carmelo Mesolago. What's pushing Cuba to take these big steps now?
Well, Cuba is suffering the worst crisis since the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the socialist camp. And there have been declines in production. There was significant cut down in 35% in imports last year. There is a very serious difficulty to get foreign credit. So they are in a very tough economic situation.
Tom Gelton was just describing to us, and we've all seen examples of this through the media or otherwise, how, you know, Cubans doing little handicrafts, toys made out of beer cans, in the very small private market, trying to make some money there. How do you take 500,000 Cubans or a million plus Cubans and get them employed in such a tiny private sector?
Well, first of all, the project itself, it makes sense, because what happens in Cuba is that, let's say that you have a factory that needs 100 workers, and so they employ 200.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the salary is cut by half. And that means that productivity is also going to be half. And therefore, the salaries are very low, production is very low. And what they are trying to do is to really hire those people that are absolutely necessary, so that productivity will go up, and then they will be able to increase salary. So this is the theory behind the move. And by the way, I have been aware of this actually. Four years ago, I estimated that putting together these guys on employment, which is what we are talking about now, plus open unemployment, which is very small in Cuba, it was 21% of the labor force. So that I published that in a document from the United Nations. So this is not a surprise for me. The important thing is that the government have acknowledged this and is trying to do it. So the big question is where these people are going to go. Now, Francis mentioned that 200,000 cooperatives will be created and 250,000 self-employed jobs. But this is not easy. As Tom said already, the number of self-employed peaked in 1996 at 210,000. So it's about what they want to create now, but it's less than half now. And why? It's because the government have put a lot of obstacles and also imposed very heavy taxes. I inspected these jobs and closed them. And for instance, there was a large number of small restaurants called Paladares in Cuba, and they could only have 12 chairs. They couldn't hire anybody else that those from the family.
Hmm.
They couldn't serve certain things like pork. And they were gradually declining until very few are left in Cuba now. So if they imposed heavy taxation and a lot of rules, it would be extremely difficult even to go back to the number that they have in 1996. And I think that the basic dilemma here is that the government, instead of placing first priority in the creation of productive jobs, is trying to do two things at the same time. One is creating jobs. The other one is getting money out of the work of these people. And taxes, for instance, have been said to be about 25% for, you know, including income tax, social security, and other things. Plus, you will have to pay a license, a permit to start working. So this is a real question, whether the government is going to try to do, you know, to get money out of this, or is going to realize that in order for this 500,000 people to be employed, they have to be more flexible in order for them to flourish.
Or might they sort of kill it looking for revenue right away off that private enterprise? Tom Gelton, you've been in Cuba a lot. Can you see this country culturally all these years after the revolution and after all the pride and effort poured into that revolution? Culturally, Could Cuba go the way of China? Could it maybe still have a, you know, Communist Party on top, but a really roaring market beneath?
I don't see any reason why Cuba could not go the way of China or Vietnam or, for that matter, Eastern Europe. I actually think in some ways what we are seeing develop in Cuba is more akin to what has happened in Eastern Europe than in China. And that is that the large number of joint ventures with foreign partners in Cuba has sort of raised the possibility of a gradual privatization there, where the state has a major role in the management of these semi-private enterprises. And one of the things that we saw in Eastern Europe was former enterprise managers sort of emerging overnight as capitalists with large equity positions in the enterprises that they used to manage. I think that there's a lot of reason to think that we'll see something similar developing there. I mean, you know, all these countries have now had 20 years of experience in developing some kind of hybrid forms of state ownership and private ownership. And so the managers of the economy in Cuba are not where they were back in 1989, 1990, 1991. There are a lot of models to look at around the world. And so I do think it's entirely possible that you could see gradually the development of some kind of hybrid model in Cuba as well.
And interesting to note that just last month, the government there issued a decree allowing foreign investors to lease government land for as much as 99 years. Let's hear from our listeners. Orleans, Vermont. Ken, you are on the air.
Yeah, I have two quick questions. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
First one is it really a layoff, or do they just, is it basically getting fired from your job? And the second one is if they are 500,000 people, are they in a general concentrated area, or is it through the whole country? I'll take the answers off the air, and thank you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Ken. Carmelo Mesolago, are they essentially just being fired? Is there anything like unemployment insurance in Cuba, or are they just being told, go out and, I'm looking at news reports here that say, you know, raise rabbits, bake bricks, collect garbage, paint buildings. Is there unemployment, or just
there is no formal unemployment insurance or unemployment compensation in Cuba. Mm-hmm. In the past, when there were problems in terms of lack of imports for inputs in industry, for instance, they pay, I think it was about half of the salary for a long time until the factories were reopened. Very little has been said about this. For instance, several weeks ago, there was a mention that the workers dismissed will receive some compensation. They didn't say what percentage of current wages for 3 months. And then there will be three offers made to them. This must be like in agriculture or construction, because there is practically nothing else outside those two sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they turn that down, then they will be on their own. But this have not been officially reported. By the way, I have to say something about the question that you asked, Tom, concerning Cuba.
Yes,
Cuba moving in the path of China or Vietnam. I think Eastern Europe, that he mentioned, that will be extremely difficult on the current circumstances in Cuba. And
why?
They have been extremely critical of the Eastern European reforms and the drop of socialism and the move into capitalism. They have been a constant in the Cuban among the Cuban
rhetoric
and
mm-hmm.
In the media.
Mm-hmm.
But even you have to make a distinction between Cuban economists and the government itself. For instance, when I was in Havana last June, I was in a meeting with Cuban economists, and two of them said very clearly that they consider that the government should only be the regulator of the economy and be in charge of the major strategic sectors, industries, etc. And that the rest should go to cooperatives and the private sector. But this is the sector that has always been in favor of reform. But the leadership, that is another issue. For instance, Fidel many times have said that the Chinese model doesn't fit Cuba. And arguing about size, foreign investment, distance from the United States, etc. But the case of Vietnam is much more similar to Cuba, and they certainly could take some of the measures applying those two countries, particularly in agriculture, and they have been quite successful.
Much more direct government.
I think that for the time being, the reforms won't go as deep as these countries have gone.
Certainly there's some of that feeling in the streets. Here's a little tape from NPR's Nick Miroff, filed this report earlier this year on some small internal protests inside Cuba. The changes brought by Raul Castro, said the Cubans he was talking to here, are superficial.
There's no space for people who really think differently, said this bystander in the park, who gave his name as Eduardo. The changes are merely cosmetic, he said. They're for people who already think the same.
Let's take a call from Orlando, Florida. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, who's waiting in the wings when the Castro brothers finally disappear or just die a natural death, perhaps?
Tom Jelton?
Well, that's a really important question, and the answer has become much murkier in the last year or so, because there was a whole second tier of leadership that seemed to be poised to kind of take over in succession. A younger generation, people like Laje, who was a vice president and kind of in charge of the whole economic reform. And a lot of these people were purged by Raul, and there are varying interpretations of why that happened. Some saw Raul as being threatened by the emergence of this new generation. Some saw the hand of sort of the old guard not wanting these so-called reformers to be moving into position. But the bottom line is that basically all the younger leaders of the Cuban government and the Cuban Communist Party, who did have very prominent positions, a great many of them were purged at this time. And right now, the leadership in Cuba is all geriatric. I mean, all in their 70s. Mm. So I think that's a really major question. I'm curious whether Professor Mesolago, in his recent trip to Cuba, got any inkling into what the thinking is there, because that's a big question.
Well, let me put that in this context, if I may. I know we only have you for another minute, Mr. Mesolago, but we were talking also with Antonio Jorge at the Florida International University, political economist there. He was talking about how dire the economic situation is in Cuba, that this big layoff is a desperate measure, he said, financial situation extreme. Never mind who will come after the Castros. He was warning that we might see with these layoffs, firings, social instability. He said it's going to be an extremely dangerous time for social stability in Cuba. What do you think, Carmelo?
Well, I have been hearing that for 50-some years.
Yeah.
I am a little bit skeptical about this. Cuban people are trying to survive. They spend a lot of time getting food, getting all the basic necessities. Certainly, the situation today is different than 10 years ago, in the sense that there are the internet is important, and there is a small number of dissidents in Cuba that have their own ways to express themselves. But the access to internet in Cuba for the general population is very small. It's very tiny. Some people have email, but they don't have access to internet. Therefore, I mean, anything could happen. This is like prediction, which I don't want to go into. But of course, he is right in this. We discussed this at the beginning of the program, that this is the worst crisis that Cuba have suffered since 1990s. Actually, one of the things that I did when I was there was to ask people, economists and people in the street, how do you compare the situation today, which that in 1993-94, which was the worst during the crisis. And they were basically, they were saying the same. It's not exactly that, but we are getting there. So it's a very serious economic situation, and that is why I think Raul is taking now more radical measures, and I fully agree with Tom about his...
Comrade Mesolago, I know we have to let you go. We're so glad that you were able to join us. Tom Jelton, please stand by. We're looking at Cuba. This is On Point. talking this hour about Cuba making changes, half a million state workers to be cut loose from their government jobs in a country where 95% of the economy is government-run. Fidel Castro making headlines. NPR's Tom Gelton is with us. I want to thank Carmelo Mesa-Lago, Professor Emeritus of Economics and Latin American Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, for being with us. We ran into the break there, but it was just great to have him. We're going to talk in a few minutes about the big Tea Party victories in primaries yesterday and what they mean for the GOP trying to straddle a lot here right now. Let's get a call here. Rudy in Des Moines, Iowa. Rudy, you're on the air.
I'm a Cuban-American. I was there about 3.5, 4 years ago. And everybody complains, of course, about the government privately. You're not about to go out in public and say it. However, if the rules change now and the public employees, including perhaps police and whatever else, are touched by this problem, are we going to see civil discontent? We're going to see people on the streets? Is that a possibility? Since there might not be anyone to control it.
That is interesting. Let us to go to that. Let me bring in Jose Azel, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Cuba and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami, author of Mañana in Cuba. Left Cuba in 1961 as a 13-year-old political exile. Then Jose Azel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You hear our question from Des Moines, from Rudy. You know, could there be unrest? And if so, will there be anybody to deal with it if they're laying off this many? Carmelo Mesa-Lago says, you know, probably not. We've been hearing that for years out of Cuba and haven't seen it. What do you think?
Well, I think I'm going to side with Carmelo on that particular point. One of the arguments that I make in Mañana in Cuba is I take a look at Cuban civil society today after 50-some years of living under a totalitarian system. Under a totalitarian system, as opposed to a democratic system, the model that describes the relationship between the people and the state is one that prescribes that changes must always come from the top down. In a democracy, we sort of have changes coming from the bottom up. Mm. So the Cuban people have become accustomed to waiting for the government to act, waiting for the government to be the one that initiates the changes, as opposed to the changes initiating with the people. So I think a certain passivity has developed. I make the very imperfect analogy with the Stockholm syndrome that we've seen and things of that nature. So I really do not anticipate civil unrest. But Tom, I wanted to go back to. And by the way, I support most of the statements that Francis and Tom and Carmelo made.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're pretty much in agreement. But I do want to touch on something that Tom and we alluded at in terms of the China model. And
yes.
By the way, I'm speaking from Casa Bacardi, and I'm a great admirer of Tom's work.
Mm.
But, you know, one of the things that we know after 30-some years of truly profound economic changes in the direction of a free market that have been introduced in China is that indeed China is far, far more prosperous today than it was and has made tremendous advances on the economic side, but not on the political side. There, according to Freedom House that takes a yearly survey, China has not advanced at all.
Well, we pretty well know that, but on the other hand, they've got some coins in their pocket now. They've got
absolutely, but some people make mm-hmm. the argument, which I think is flawed, that economic improvements lead inexorably to political improvements,
right.
And China demonstrates that is not the case. If all we're concerned with is about improving the economic well-being, then that is a model to follow, but. As a Cuban-American, I also want freedom for the Cuban people. I want civil rights and political rights. And the other point that I think Tom also alluded to is the military control of the economy. About 60 to 70% of Cuba's economy today is controlled by the military under certain arrangements that they have. A model that we can take a look at is not a very good one, is what happened in Russia. And one of the things that we saw in Russia, and I think Forbes magazine about 2 years ago published an article on this, that at that time, only 17 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia had the second largest number of billionaires in the planet, following only the United States.
And that's with still a very heavy central government hand involved.
Well, and besides that, what happened was is that most of these guys were ex-KGB. So Russia did not transition to a democracy, but perhaps to a kleptocracy.
Jose, hold that thought if you would, and Tom, I'll come right to you. But we've got, let me go to Amy in Easton, Massachusetts. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was studying in 1988 in Almaty, Kazakhstan, in a big university, something like MIT.
Are you Russian, Amy? Are you a Russian?
Yes, uh-huh. I was born there, but uh-huh. Now I'm American.
Uh-huh.
there was Cuban students by thousands studying in all kind of different engineering. Mm-hmm. And I used to ask them, oh, guys, your country is such a small, what you going to do there? You are so many of them.
Yeah.
They used to say, something, they will find something. But by conversations, lots of conversations, I figured out for the end that they are not happy with life, what they have in Cuba, and they would rather do something for themselves. So that time I didn't understand, but now I do. And hopefully they will do better than Russia.
Amy, I appreciate your call. Tom, I couldn't resist with Russia as a on the table. Turning to Amy there, what about this issue of where Cuba could actually turn? And Jose Azell remains maybe as interested in political freedom as economic freedom. Do you see either really emerging here? Does Cuba have a choice anymore? Is it going to be driven by economic necessity if the finances are so dire?
Well, I think that one of the things that Jose was suggesting is that we could see the development of something similar to what he called the kleptocracy in the former Soviet bloc in Cuba. And I think that what I was saying earlier mm-hmm. is that the experience of a lot of these Cuban enterprise managers who are themselves Communist Party functionaries of working in a world market puts them in a position. They sort of know they sort of know how to survive in a market situation. And I do think that you could see something developing in Cuba akin to what developed in the former Soviet bloc, where you have former nomenklatura turning sort of overnight into capitalists because they know how to play the game. That's where I see a similarity between Cuba and the former Soviet bloc. Now, as far as the China model is concerned, I think that there is one difference between Cuba and China, which is that, and Jose also mentioned this in talking about the passivity of so many people in Cuba. You know, when people are sort of forced into a kind of private sector and self-employment, you know, they lose that dependence on the state. And that could bring about a sort of a, in my view, a kind of a different attitude toward themselves, towards the government. That's potentially a point of difference, I think, between Cuba and China, to the extent that privatization process may erode that pervasive sense of passivity and paternalism that I think has really been a brake on change in Cuba. I think that is a potential difference between Cuba and China.
Jose Azell, we've just got half a minute here. What do you foresee, if you had to look into the crystal ball, political upheaval, a free market upheaval, muddling along?
Muddling along. Unfortunately, I don't see a genuine transition to free market and democracy. I see a succession of a sort. And until, frankly, from my point of view, until the Castro brothers are out of the picture, and biology will take its course and there will be a biological solution to that. Until that happens, I don't think we will see a true reformer emerge in Cuba. And it may take a couple of iterations. It's not going to be the putative successor Machado Ventura or Ramiro Valdez or one of those guys. Hopefully we will see Gorbachev emerge at some point, a true reformer.
Maybe. You may be right, but if everything goes as announced, 500,000 Cubans facing a new reality, at least by next spring. Jose Azell, at the Institute for Cuba and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Tom Gelton at NPR, author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Tom, always great to have you. Thanks so much for being here.
Always great to be on your program, Tom.
In a moment, the Tea Party Express rolls on. This is On Point.
It will be hard work, but we can win. And if those same people who fought against me work just as hard for me, we will win.
That's Tea Party-backed candidate Christine O'Donnell issuing a challenge to the GOP establishment last night in Delaware after she pulled off a stunning victory over the Republican mainline candidate, nine-term Representative Mike Castle, in the Republican Senate primary. O'Donnell's Tea Party win and others are raising big issues for the GOP heading into November's midterm elections. Jonathan Martin is senior political writer for Politico. His headline today, Soul Searching Time, a GOP Torn. He joins us now from Washington. Jonathan, I see your last date or byline here with a 4:35 a.m. timestamp on it, so I know you haven't had a whole lot of sleep, but thank you for being here.
Well, it's good to join you. It was a late night, but look, when you love American politics, it's not really a tough task. It's not a burden to stay up late and sort of cover some of these races. What an extraordinary evening. I think that the big takeaway from this is the Republican Party, historically top-down, button-down, command and control, is now being driven by the grassroots. The powers that be in Washington, D.C. are at best bystanders now. The elected officials, the sort of operative class, do not have the clout anymore. This is now a party controlled by, A, the people themselves, the grassroots, who are empowered by the Internet and by what Tom Friedman calls the flattened world, and secondly, driven by media personalities and political personalities, Sarah Palin, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck. Those folks all emphatically have more juice than any elected official right now in the GOP, and this is a remarkable departure from this party's tradition.
But where does that leave the GOP? I mean, what advantages does that bring, and what challenges does that bring the GOP?
Given the energy that we've seen, I think it's mostly for the good this year in the short term. If you look at the primary so far this year and you compare the GOP to Democrats, the Republicans have had much higher turnout. There's a lot more enthusiasm on their side. Now, there's so much enthusiasm that it can lead to what some establishment types in the party would call excess. And I think they'd point to last night where there is this sort of energy on the right that is so powerful that it can topple some folks in their own party and perhaps imperil some otherwise obvious pickups. But it's more for the good because the assumption is all the energy is going to be channeled in November towards the Democrats, and that means major pickups in the House, Senate, and among governors.
Well, I mean, you say energy, and definitely there's a big enthusiasm gap in the polls here, but the Democrats are celebrating today. Here's Democratic Party Chief Tom Kaine saying that Christine O'Donnell's primary win in Delaware, just for one, shows that Democrats have, he says, a super chance to win in November and retain control of the Senate. Everybody basically agrees that doesn't sound like a short-term win.
Well, there's no question that the math for the GOP getting back to the Senate was very, very tough at the start of the year. Now, the past few weeks, as this sort of climate became obviously bad for Democrats, there appeared to be a path for the GOP to take back those 10 seats necessary to win the Senate. It was still a pretty long shot, something of a reach. Now, I agree, after Delaware last night, it probably is going to be even tougher, if not impossible. And there are a lot of folks in the GOP that agree with that. But I think their point is, even if they don't get the 10 seats necessary, this kind of energy is going to propel them to get back the House, to pick up a lot of governor seats, and to win at least 7 or 8 seats in the Senate this fall.
But what happens with the Republican Party now over time? Do they slide right to the Tea Party positions and tone and anger? And if they do that, can they really win? That's very, very popular in this part of the base we're seeing in the primaries. We get that, but what about with the general electorate?
And not just that, but what happens after November? As fascinating as these next 2 months are going to be, the better story may be what happens, A, in the months immediately following November, when you got these folks arriving in Washington and sort of putting their imprint on the congressional wing of the party, and then B, what happened in 2011 when we see the first skirmishing for the GOP nomination for president? How are the establishment types, Mitt Romney, Haley Barbour, Mitch Daniels, Tim Pawlenty, how are they going to navigate this new world, these new rules where the Tea Party folks rule, where Palin, where Hannity, where Beck and Limbaugh rule the party? How are they going to navigate that? That's going to be really fascinating to watch. So short-term gain, yes, for Republicans as far as pickups in November, but how are they going to go forward grappling with what is now a party that effectively does not have any establishment leadership, does not have any sort of full-time institutional top-down command and control anymore?
Does that bode well for the GOP long-term? Tea Party people say that's just what we want. We want to take it over from the, you know, from the bottom up. Is that a winning strategy long-term?
Well, I think that depends upon where the center of this country is. And I think right now, if you look at polling, independents in this country tend to be more sympathetic to the Tea Party concerns about spending and about the role of the federal government than they are with Democrats and with the administration. The question going forward is, does that sympathy among centrist voters for the Tea Party movement continue going after November when these folks are actually perhaps governing, and then secondly, on the more prominent national stage of a presidential run? You know, can the Tea Party folks keep the middle? That's going to be the real question. I think that could ultimately define the 2012 White House race.
Jonathan Martin is senior political reporter for Politico, up most of the night after a very big primary day, soul-searching time, a GOP torn, he writes today at Politico. Jonathan Martin, thank you very much for being
with
us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby, with help from Mackenzie Knowles Corson and Jessica Willingham. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.